Alessandra says. Her spoon hovers over the peak of ice cream. Lisbeth considers confronting Alessandra with her lie about Mac and the beach club, but she doesn't, because the fact is, she can't afford for Alessandra to get defensive and quit. I thought, maybe we could get to know each other a little? Lisbeth hears how hokey this sounds, even pandering, as though she's sucking up to the most popular girl at school. Can we please be friends? She changes tack. Would you like me to call you an Uber? Where are you living? I don't need an Uber. I can walk. I'm living on Hulbert Avenue. Hulbert Avenue? Lisbeth thinks. That's the most exclusive address in town. All of those homes front the harbor. Nice, Lisbeth says. Are you renting on Hulbert? I have a friend with a house, Alessandra says. I didn't realize you knew anyone here. It's a new friend. Alessandra holds Lisbeth's gaze and licks ice cream off the back of her spoon. Someone I met on the boat over here. What? Lisbeth thinks. Alessandra met someone on the boat and now has a place to live on Hulbert? Wow, lucky you, Lisbeth says. Her voice sounds a little arch, so she tries to soften it. How was your first day? Alessandra gives Lisbeth a pointed look that seems to say, please go away and leave me to my ice cream. It was a day. Lisbeth changes into white jeans, a hydrangea blue blouse, and, a pair of running shoes. She steps out to the desk and observes evening settling over the lobby. Golden, syrupy sunlight pours in through the open front doors, and guests head out to dinner. Though, of course, not as many guests as Lisbeth would like. The lobby feels a bit like a badly attended party. What can she do to increase occupancy? The hotel isn't cheap. It shouldn't be cheap. But it's slightly less expensive than their competitors are. Lisbeth decides to reach out to every media outlet, all those places that fawningly covered the deck. It would be nice to have some help from Xavier, but he doesn't seem concerned that their numbers are low. He cares only about the fifth key. Kimber Marsh's son, Louis, the name completely suits the little dude. In his seersucker shorts and pressed white polo, he's both cute and formal, like a child king, wanders into the lobby alone, settles at one of the chessboards, and begins moving pieces. Lisbeth watches him for a second, wondering if Kimber will appear. Mr. and Mrs. Stamm from room 303 stop by him on their way out the door.
You really know what you're doing, Mr. Stamm says to Louis. How old are you?
Louis doesn't look up.
6 and a half.
Mr. Stamm chuckles and says to his wife, a prodigy. Louis moves his white rook and says,
checkmate.
He turns to Mr. Stamm.
Do you want to play?
Mr. Stamm laughs. I'm on my way out right now, but maybe tomorrow. How about that? Louis shrugs and the Stamms leave. Lisbeth considers going over and offering to play with Louis, but then she sees the break room door open and Alessandra slip out. Lisbeth gets a nutty idea that she immediately dismisses. She's losing her mind. She's been at the hotel for nearly 12 hours and she has to last until midnight. But she deserves a quick break, and she's the boss, so there's no one to stop her. Alessandra heads down the front stairs and pulls a bike off the rack. It's one of the hotel bikes. Has she asked if she can use it? Lisbeth approaches Raoul, who is posted by the front door and has the upright bearing of a guard at Buckingham Palace. Do you mind watching the desk for 20 minutes or so while I get some air?
Not at all, Raoul says.
Raoul has an old-school gallantry that Lisbeth just adores, and she briefly congratulates herself on a good hire. Little Louis is inside playing chess, and I don't see his mother, so if you don't mind keeping an eye on him, she winces. I know you're not a babysitter.
Happy to, Raoul says.
Do you play chess?
Lisbeth asks.
I do, actually, Raoul says. If it's quiet, maybe I'll let him beat me.
Terrific. Thank you.
Lisbeth watches Alessandra pedal off down Easton Street. I'll be right back. Lisbeth also grabs a hotel bike. They're brand new white Treks.
Xavier bought a fleet of 35 and takes off behind Alessandra. She savors the wind in her face, the softness of the air, and the gilded tone of the lowering sun, trying to ignore the fact that what she's doing is completely unhinged. She's following Alessandra home. If someone were filming this from above, they would see two women in identical outfits, one surreptitiously pursuing the other. The tail of Lisbeth's blue blouse billows out behind her. She hums the Wicked Witch's theme music in her head. Alessandra goes all the way down Easton, past Great Point Properties, past the entrance to Children's Beach, past the White Elephant, and Lisbeth trails at a distance. She catches a whiff of garlic and butter coming from the Brant Point Grill, and her stomach rumbles. She hasn't eaten a thing all day. Alessandra passes all the grand waterfront homes on the right and takes the curved left turn onto Hulbert before the Coast Guard station and the Brant Point light. Lisbeth follows. A few cars pass, and Lisbeth is afraid she'll see someone she knows. A bunch of customers from the deck live on Hulbert. She and JJ used to be invited out here to private pool parties and croquet matches all the time. They'd become friends with two couples, the Bicks and the Laytons, both of whom live in this neighborhood. The Bicks' house, which has a tennis court, is up ahead, and Alessandra slows down. There's no way that Alessandra is living at the Bicks' house, is there? Michael and Heidi are the quintessential golden couple. They're both tall, lean, and blonde, and they have four young, tow-headed children. Maybe Alessandra has struck some kind of deal where she watches the kids in the evenings in exchange for housing, but that doesn't feel quite right. Heidi has a full-time nanny. And something about the way Alessandra said, "I have a friend with a house, a new friend, someone I met on the boat," was sexual in nature. Lisbeth thought Alessandra was intimating that she'd met a guy on the boat, the guy invited her back to his house, and now she's living there. Alessandra stops, swings her leg off her bike, and turns around. "Are you following me?" she says. Lisbeth's foot slips off the pedal and the bike wobbles, but Lisbeth pulls the handlebars straight, hits the brakes, and doesn't crash. She has no idea what to say. She considers chastising Alessandra for taking a hotel bike without asking, but that seems petty. "I saw you head out and I decided I could use a ride as well. It's such a beautiful afternoon and I have to work the desk tonight." Lisbeth glances at the Bicks' house. The gate to the tennis court is ajar and there's a racket lying on the bench, so the Bicks must be back on island. Lisbeth dearly hopes they aren't watching this exchange from their window. She started out the day strong, but now she has devolved into some kind of psycho boss who follows her employees home. With great awkwardness, Lisbeth wheels her bike around. "See you tomorrow." She pedals away, fighting the urge to check where Alessandra is headed. She tells herself it's none of her business. When she arrives back at the desk, she finds Raoul and Louis deeply involved in a chess match. Raoul looks up with wide eyes. "The kid is whooping my butt, fair and square." Lisbeth nods, preoccupied with her embarrassment. What must Alessandra think of her? It's mortifying. And yet Lisbeth still feels that something isn't right, something bigger than lying about an interview that could be seen as strategic, and bigger than taking a bike without asking. Who cares? She'll bring it back tomorrow. Once Lisbeth assures herself that nothing pressing needs her attention, she retrieves her cell phone from her office and surreptitiously slides it next to her computer, even though this is, by her own decree, forbidden. She sends a text to Heidi Bick. "Hey girl, just thinking of you. Are you on island? Now that I'm not working at the deck, we can actually go out to dinner this summer. Let me know when you're free so we can catch up." She hits send and takes a breath. Then she decides to place another ad for a night auditor in the Nantucket Standard Classifieds. She won't be able to go anywhere or do anything until she hires someone. This time, she lists the pay, $25 per hour plus possible bonuses. Hopefully, that will do the trick. Suddenly, a young woman is at the desk, holding out a white cardboard box. It's Beatrice from the Blue Bar. Chef asked me to deliver this to you with his compliments, she says.
Chef, Lisbeth thinks. Mario Subiaco. She recalls that morning, JJ's proposal, the fruit frenzy on the zebra wood cutting board, and the cocktail. She could really use that cocktail now.
Thank you, Lisbeth says.
She opens the top of the box and nearly swoons.
It's called the bakery box, Beatrice says. One of Chef's specialties. Clockwise, you have homemade pizza rolls, gougère filled with bechamel, and two favorites from the Blue Bistro. Savory rosemary and onion donuts, and pretzel bread served with his signature honey mustard.
Sweet lightning, Lisbeth thinks. This looks amazing.
Chef wanted to be sure you ate something delicious today, Beatrice says, and she vanishes through the door that leads back into the bar.
Lisbeth hears laughter and chatter and Nat King Cole singing Unforgettable. It sounds fun and lively. Lisbeth feels a pang. Despite her bravado, she misses the restaurant business. She isn't sure where to start. She wants to inhale the whole box of goodies, but she picks up one of the two glistening, golden brown donuts because she has heard stories about them.
Gah!
The donut is so good that Lisbeth's eyelids flutter closed and she has to keep herself from moaning. Next, she nibbles the end of one of the flaky triangular pizza rolls and finds it chock full of crumbled sausage and pepperoni in a sauce that's slightly spicy. It's so insanely delicious that she feels guilty. She casts a glance at Raoul and Louis. Raoul stands up and announces,
I should get back to my post.
Louis returns the pieces to their home squares. Raoul swings by the desk and says,
That kid is something else. I thought I would let him win, and he killed me.
Oh, so reluctantly, Lisbeth offers Raoul the box. Would you like a donut or some pretzel bread? She dearly hopes he doesn't take a gougère because there are only three. Raoul waves the box away.
Thank you, but I don't eat carbs.
Ha, brilliant.
Raoul heads back to the bell stand, and Lisbeth absconds with her box of treasure to her office, but keeps an eye on Louis through the doorway. He starts another game against himself, but then Wanda appears, holding a notebook and a pencil, and says,
Mom wants you back in the suite, Louis, come on.
In a minute. Louis says, I'm playing.
Wanda puts her hands on her hips like an aggrieved mother.
You have a board in the room.
Louis sighs, then follows his sister down the hall. Lisbeth pops a gougère into her mouth and it explodes with creamy bechamel. Not bad, Subiaco, she thinks. She remembers the night 15 years earlier when JJ asked her to help him with some recipe development. He was trying to perfect an oyster pan roast, and Lisbeth sat on a high stool in the kitchen at the deck while JJ hand-fed her a plump, briny, raw oyster, then a spoonful of the pan sauce, cream, bacon, thyme. This led to their first kiss, which led to them dating, then sleeping together, then, at the end of the summer, living together, and then to them buying the cottage on Bear Street and running the restaurant side by side, until she discovered the pornographic texts on his phone. If anyone knows the dangers of being seduced by food, it's Lisbeth Keaton. And yet, she tears off a hunk of pretzel bread and swipes it lavishly through the honey mustard. She can't stop. She decides to take a picture of the bakery box and send it to JJ. He'll be jealous and think she's gloating. She is. But when Lisbeth picks up her phone, she sees a text from Heidi Bick.
Hey girl, sorry, I was scooping Hayford from jiu-jitsu practice. I'm still in Greenwich. I leave for the island a week from Friday after the kids finish school. Michael has been up there for a couple months already working on a top secret project that requires complete silence, which cannot, of course, be found at home. I'm free any night after the 18th. It will def be Michael's turn to hang with the kids. Maybe you can get us into the Blue Bar? I heard it's going to be the new hotspot. Love you, XOXO.
Lisbeth blinks. Heidi is back in Connecticut with the kids, and Michael has been on the island for a couple of months working on a top secret project?
That doesn't mean he's sleeping with her front desk manager, Lisbeth tells herself. Being cheated on has destroyed Lisbeth's faith in humanity. She automatically thinks the worst of everyone. It wasn't clear that Alessandra was pulling into the Bix house. That was just where she stopped to confront Lisbeth. It was as if she had eyes in the back of her head. It was a little scary, to be honest. Lisbeth said she wanted to know everyone's secrets, but she understands now that she doesn't. She pops another gougère into her mouth. She doesn't at all.
Chapter 7. Bad Reviews. June 15th, 2022. From Xavier Darling, xd@darlingent.com.uk. To employees of the Hotel Nantucket. Good day, team. We have a sticky situation on our hands, I'm afraid. The reviews of our property on Travel Tattler for the first week were primarily negative. Now, I understand that people are more likely to leave a review when they have a problem, and that it's highly likely that all the guests who didn't leave a review left the hotel feeling perfectly content and satisfied with their stay. However, I will not be awarding the $1,000 bonus this week. I hope you all realize that a satisfied guest isn't enough. I want you, please, to make every effort to see that our guests leave jubilant, energized, and inspired to tell the internet about their unparalleled stay at the Hotel Nantucket. This is not meant as punishment or even a reprimand. Please think of this email as an impetus to take your guest service skills to the next level. Thank you. XD. Travel Tattler Reviews. The Hotel Nantucket, Nantucket, Massachusetts. Dates of your stay, June 11th to 13th. Number of people in your party, 3. Name, optional. Please rate the following areas of the hotel on a scale of 1 to 10. Reception, check-in, 10. Room cleanliness, 10. Style, decor, 10. Concierge, 10. Wellness center, 10. Pools, 10. Room service minibar, 10. Overall experience, 2. Please feel free to leave additional comments about your stay, singling out any staff members who made your visit memorable. I wish you had a category for rating the bell staff, because that would answer the riddle of how my two gal pals and I could love everything about this hotel and still give it a 2-star experience overall. The bellman who was on duty during our stay was not only full of himself, but also incredibly rude, unfriendly, and unaccommodating. He ruined what was an otherwise wonderful experience. We also suspect he was behind some inexplicable phenomena that happened in our room on the final night of our stay. He should be fired promptly. Grace has been watching the day-to-day activity at the hotel unfold with great interest, and although she's biased, she happens to think her crush Zeke English is doing a terrific job. He was a little awkward during the first week while he was learning the ropes, and admittedly, he's nowhere near as polished as Adam, who works with Zeke during the day, or Raoul, who works nights. But today is June 11th, the start of week 2, and Zeke has clicked into gear like a fine race car. When Roger's taxi pulls up to the front of the hotel and disgorges 3 very exuberant-looking women of a certain age, Adam nudges Zeke and says, "All yours, stallion." And Zeke strides over with his winning smile, shoulders back, to welcome the ladies to the hotel. The ringleader of the 3 women introduces herself as Daniela, then turns to her 2 friends and says, "Look at this hottie, gals." Gals? Grace thinks. That term is straight out of 1977. It makes Grace think of Farrah Fawcett Majors, the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders, and Charlie Perfume. Everyone staying in the hotel that year wore it. The other 2 women are Claire, frumpy, and Allison, hippy dippy. Claire tells Zeke that the 3 of them are from Florida and have come to the island to whoop it up. Again, Grace wonders, who says that anymore? It's Daniela's 50th birthday, and they're also celebrating Daniela's shiny new divorce.
I'm on the prowl, Daniela crows, like only a woman who lost her orthodontist husband to one of his patients' mothers can be.
Daniela is tall, with ringlets of black hair down to her waist and a wide mouth. She's a not-quite-Cher.
Oh dear, Grace thinks. She sees trouble barreling down on Zeke like a freight train.
Zeke delivers the ladies' bags to Suite 117 and displays its wonders: the sound system, the electric shades, the complimentary minibar. Daniela hands Zeke a $100 bill and asks him to stay for a beer.
Thank you so much for the offer, ladies, but I'm on the clock for another 5 hours, so I'll have to take a rain check.
We expect to see you later, Daniela says.
She squeezes Zeke's biceps through his hydrangea blue button-down.
Look at these guns!
Allison, who has frizzled gray blonde hair and is wearing a tie-dyed sundress, shrieks,
Daniela!
Claire, who wears glasses and mom jeans, blinks at Zeke and says, You are quite the snack, which actually makes Zeke laugh. But he hightails it out of there. Grace is relieved that Zeke gets off work before the ladies leave their room, buzzed from the bottle of Laurent Perrier Rosé they ordered from the Blue Bar, and head out to dinner at Lola. Claire briefly tries to flirt with Raoul, asking if he's taken, and Raoul deadpans perfectly that yes, he's married to Adam, the day bellman. That shuts them up. The next morning, Grace sees Zeke arrive at the hotel, not in his uniform as usual, but in workout clothes. He heads down to the yoga studio, and Grace follows. There are 8 or 9 women stretching, in anticipation of Yolanda's bar class. When Yolanda takes her place at the front of the room, Grace sees Zeke melt a little. Aha. Grace can hardly blame him. 27-year-old Yolanda Tolentino looks like Chrissy Teigen's little sister. She has tousled dark hair, highlighted auburn, flawless skin, big brown eyes, and a deep dimple in her left cheek. Her body is trim, limber, flexible. Over the past few weeks, Grace has seen Yolanda float through the lobby. Once, she stopped to talk to Lisbeth and held a tree pose, foot tucked against opposite knee, hands held over her head like branches, which was unusual but also impressive. Another time, Yolanda was waiting for the elevator and executed a full-on backbend, which caused Mr. Goldfarb from room 202 to hiccup in surprise. Yolanda, Grace is happy to report, is as lovely on the inside as she is on the outside. And she must eat like a horse. She's back and forth between the yoga studio and the kitchen of the Blue Bar 6 times a day. When Yolanda sees Zeke, she hurries over to get him set up at the bar with a ball, a looped resistance band, and 2-pound hand weights. Zeke says, looking at the tiny lavender weights.
I've held burritos that weigh more than this.
Feel free to switch them out for heavier ones, Yolanda says. Just remember, I warned you. And unfortunately, I don't have any grippy socks that will fit you.
Big feet, says a woman just walking in.
It's Daniela. She's followed by Allison and Claire.
We know what that means, don't we, gals?
No, this won't do, Grace thinks.
She blows cold air down the back of Daniela's neck, and as she does so, she inhales the unmistakable scent of last night's tequila. Daniela doesn't notice the draft. Possibly she welcomes it. When Claire and Allison spot Zeke, they start furiously whispering. Grace is embarrassed for them. She has seen 14-year-olds with more composure.
Zeke is a bar virgin, Daniela cries out. Don't worry, I'll be right behind you, Zeke, admiring your form.
Me too, Allison says.
She's wearing leggings printed with rainbows and peace signs.
I'm moving closer, Claire says.
She has on a t-shirt that reads, I date everybody. Yolanda starts the music.
Ladies, let's try to focus.
She lifts her leg while crossing her arms in front of her chest. Zeke follows suit. He can't lift his leg very high at all, or maybe he can, but he's simply too enraptured by Yolanda, in her white leggings and her hydrangea blue tank, with her hair in a thick braid hanging over one shoulder, to try very hard. Leg lifts transition to planks on the yoga mats, followed by push-ups. Grace watches Zeke do all this with ease. When the class moves to the bar, Yolanda says, "Who's ready for a thigh party?" Daniela hoots and raises her arms over her head, giving Zeke an unimpeded view of her chest. Grace notices that she has removed the pads from her yoga top so that Zeke can see her nipples protruding.
"Heels together, toes apart," Yolanda says. "Now sink down 6 inches and find your high diamond."
Zeke tries to approximate the position, but his heels lift only an inch off the ground. When he sinks down, he winces.
"Up an inch," Yolanda says, "and down an inch. Remember, an inch is the size of a paperclip."
When they press down to finish, Zeke's legs shake uncontrollably. It's the funniest thing Grace has seen in a long time.
"End of the first set," Yolanda says, "two to go."
Zeke looks longingly at the door.
"Everyone grab your balls," Yolanda says.
Danielle rolls her tongue. "Now you're talking," she says. When bar class ends, there's a standoff. Zeke seems to want to chat up Yolanda, but Daniela, Allison, and Claire are clearly lingering in order to talk to Zeke.
Yolanda says, "Thanks for coming, everyone. I'm going to run to the restaurant for an acai bowl before I teach yoga. Ta!"
Daniela, Allison, and Claire close in on Zeke, who has his back up against the bar.
"Tonight's my birthday dinner at Ventuno," Daniela says. "Then we're going to the club car to sing and hopefully to the Pearl for a nightcap."
"Guess what we're giving Daniela for a present," Claire says.
Zeke tells the ladies he can't begin to guess.
"You," Allison says. "Please join us. We'll pay for everything."
"Wish I could, ladies," Zeke says, "but I have to work tonight."
"That's okay," Daniela says. "There's always the after party."
Zeke is a sitting duck when the ladies from Suite 117 enter the lobby that evening in a flurry of high-pitched cackling and waves of perfume. The three of them are dressed in sequins and feathers and high heels with red soles. Daniela is wearing a tiara. Zeke takes a visible breath.
"He's such a good sport," Grace thinks.
"Here's my birthday queen," Zeke says, taking Daniela's hand and allowing her to twirl. "Love the Louboutins."
The ladies scream, "He knows about Louboutins!"
Allison says,
"Let's get a selfie. Daniela, you stand next to Zeke."
Daniela crushes herself against one side of Zeke, and Claire does the same on the other side, while Allison, on the far side of Claire, holds her phone out in front of them.
"Everyone say, duck, duck, goose!"
She presses the button at the same time that both Daniela and Claire squeeze Zeke's butt cheeks.
"Whoa,"
Zeke says, raising his arms and stepping back.
"What?"
Grace thinks. It might be time for her to show her resting bitch face on Claire's phone screen. These ladies are out of line. At that moment, Roger's taxi pulls up and the ladies pile in. As the car pulls away, they wave at Zeke out the open window. Grace dearly hopes that by the time Daniela, Allison, and Claire return, Zeke will be off work and safely home in bed. But at 12:45, Daniela stumbles up the stairs in her heels. Claire, behind her, is holding her shoes in her hand, and Allison is still down on the sidewalk doing some kind of psychedelic dance to music apparently only she can hear.
"They're drunk," Grace thinks, "as blotto as Dahlia Benedict used to get back in the good old days."
"Hey, ladies," Zeke says. His voice is weary. "How was the birthday?"
Daniela snakes an arm around Zeke's waist and snuggles against him.
"We have a proposition for you."
The church bells in town toll midnight.
"All propositions will have to wait until tomorrow, ladies. I'm getting off my shift and I'm beat. I'll see you in the morning."
"Oh, no, you don't,"
Daniela says, her tone of voice serrated now.
"We're calling in that rain check. Come upstairs and have champagne with us," she says, pulling him out of the lobby. "Don't be afraid," Allison says. "We don't bite."
"Speak for yourself," Claire says.
Daniela pulls $500 bills out of her purse.
"We'll tip you for your excellent service."
Zeke holds up his palms. I'm sorry, ladies. He takes careful steps backward into the lobby, which is deserted.
I'm here, Zeke, Grace thinks. I'm here.
I have to get home now. You all have a good night, and happy birthday, Daniela.
It's my 50th birthday, Daniela says. Just come up for 10 minutes.
Absolutely not, Grace thinks. She needs to get help. She widens her scope and sees the answer just on the other side of the door that leads to the blue bar. Grace, ever so gently, puts a hand on Yolanda's back.
Hey, Zeke!
Yolanda steps into the lobby, holding a takeout box. She's wearing a stretchy black cat suit, a pork pie hat, and a pair of Chuck Taylors. She waves at the ladies and slips her arm through Zeke's.
Would you mind walking me out to my car?
Zeke exhales. Of course, I was just leaving myself. Good night, ladies.
But,
Daniela says. Zeke and Yolanda step out onto the front porch. Daniela, Allison, and Claire stare after him.
Thank you, Zeke whispers to Yolanda.
You don't have to walk me anywhere, Yolanda says, pointing across the street to a vintage metallic green Bronco with a white top.
She smiles up at him, revealing the cute dimple.
I had the most incredible meal at the Blue Bar tonight. Have you eaten there yet?
Yolanda sighs.
I'm madly in love with the chef.
You are? Zeke says.
She's in love with Mario Subiaco? Grace thinks.
Well, that explains why she spends so much time in the kitchen.
Yolanda skips down the stairs with a wave.
Have a good night, Zeke.
She drives off and Zeke stares after her. He turns around to see the backlit figure of Daniela standing in the lobby. She crooks a finger at him, but Zeke runs for home.
Good night, sweet prince, Grace thinks.
Then she follows the ladies to Suite 117. Claire passes out face down on the bed in the second bedroom.
She's going to miss all the fun, Grace thinks.
Allison declares she's drawing herself a bath, and in a few moments the tub is filled with steaming water. She takes the box of matches from the little table next to the tub and tries to light the lemon and mint candle, but the match sputters and goes out. She tries a second match, but it happens again. And again. She can't get a match to stay lit. She turns on the pearly light around the mirror, and this sets a similar mood, so she steps one foot into the tub. She shrieks. The water is ice cold. And then the light goes out.
Daniela!
She cries. Daniela is in the master bedroom trying to make the electronic shade go down. Every time she pushes the button to lower the shade starts to go down, but then, as if it changed its mind, it travels back up. Grace is delighted. The petals of the lilies and peonies in the Surfside spring bouquet wither and fall to the table. And while Daniela is gasping at this, Grace whips the shade all the way up. Daniela picks up the phone to call the front desk, but there isn't a dial tone. She flops on the bed, still in her red-soled shoes, and pulls a pillow over her face. Grace goes into the sound system, and an instant later, music is blaring. Quiet Riot's Come On, Feel the Noise. Daniela sits bolt upright in bed, and Grace laughs and laughs. She hasn't had this much fun since Girls Were Gals. Travel Tattler Reviews. The Hotel Nantucket, Nantucket, Massachusetts. Dates of your stay: June 12th to 15th. Number of people in your party: 1. Name, optional: Franny Yates. Please rate the following areas of the hotel on a scale of 1 to 10. Reception check-in: 1. Room cleanliness: 10. Style decor: 10. Concierge: 10. Wellness center: 10. Pools: 10. Room service minibar: 10. Overall experience: 5.5. Please feel free to leave additional comments about your stay, singling out any staff members who made your visit memorable. I enjoyed my 3-night stay at the Hotel Nantucket. However, I'm only giving it 5.5 stars overall because the night of my check-in was an unmitigated disaster. And had the hour not been so late and had every other room on the island not already been booked, I would have left immediately. The front desk clerk and the night bellman were harried and distracted, and the front desk clerk was, at one point, snippy with me. Then it took the night bellman 30 minutes to deliver my bags to my room when all I wanted to do was put on my pajamas and go to sleep. Furthermore, when the bellman came, he neglected to explain any features of the room. I didn't realize until my final day, while chatting with a lovely couple at the adult pool, that everything in the minibar was complimentary. The blue bar, however, was outstanding and the perfect place to eat as a party of one. I went all 3 evenings of my stay. My compliments to the chef. This review, forwarded to her by Xavier, is waiting in Lisbeth's inbox when she gets to work on June 16th. She could easily check their Travel Tattler reviews herself, but she's too busy overseeing operations at the hotel, and Xavier has a 5-hour jump on the day, which feels like an unfair advantage. The comments accompanying this survey read as follows.
Good morning, Elizabeth.
After reading this survey, I checked the schedule and discovered that the night desk clerk was you and that the night bellman was Raul Wasserman Ramirez. I suppose I don't need to mention that, as the GM, you must uphold our rigorous hospitality standards. The hotel isn't anywhere near full, so I would urge you to pay close attention to the guests who are in residence. The woman who wrote this review could easily have been Shelley Carpenter. Keep your eye on the fifth key, Elizabeth. The fifth key. XD. Lisbeth is starting to resent Xavier Darling. How dare he judge her when he's in London and she's here, chest deep in the trenches? He checked the schedule, as though he's Big Brother. Bah! He can send all the admonishing emails he wants, but he isn't going to impress Shelley Carpenter or the second woman, whoever she is, if he doesn't help her deal with their staffing shortages and low occupancy. Even so, Lisbeth's indignation, and why can he not call her Lisbeth like she's asked him to, is mixed with guilt and culpability. That woman, Franny Yates of Trapp, Pennsylvania, checked in 3 hours late. Not her fault, Cape Air was delayed due to fog during a moment of crisis. The crisis involved Wanda Marsh. The Marsh children had made themselves quite at home at the hotel. Every morning and every evening, Louis would come down to the lobby in a polo shirt buttoned to the top, his hair wet and combed, wearing his funny little glasses, and he would sit at a chessboard playing against himself, waiting for one of the guests to notice him and offer to play a game. Louis always won, and he became something of a curiosity. A 6.5-year-old chess genius right there in the lobby of the Hotel Nantucket. One of the guests, Mr. Brandon, room 301, had written about Louis in his Travel Tattler review, saying how much he'd enjoyed playing chess every morning with Louis while he drank his cup of percolated Jamaica Blue Mountain coffee. Lisbeth was just waiting for Xavier to award Louis the $1,000 bonus. Wanda wandered the hotel freely as well. She always had a Nancy Drew mystery in her hand. She was working her way through them in chronological order, though her mother had only bought her up to number 12, the message in the hollow oak, and she was already on number 9, the sign of the twisted candles, so she would soon be out of books. Wanda had also started carrying a spiral notebook and a number 2 pencil because she wanted to write her own mystery novel starring girl sleuth Wanda Marsh. She was constantly asking people, staff, and guests alike if they had noticed anything strange or secret around the hotel, but the only mystery she'd learned of was the case of the disappearing almond croissants. It was unusual how rapidly Beatrice's croissants, filled with almond-flavored marzipan, vanished from the continental breakfast. And why didn't the kitchen ever make a second batch? Unlike her children, Kimber Marsh was having a difficult time settling in. Back on the 3rd night of their stay, Kimber had wandered down to the lobby at 1 in the morning. Lisbeth was on the night desk.
I suffer from chronic insomnia, Kimber said.
Lisbeth nearly asked if they could switch places,
Kimber could watch the desk, and Lisbeth would go to Suite 114 and sleep in the Emperor-sized bed. Kimber poured herself a giant cup of coffee. Coffee? And leaned against the desk to have a chat. Fine, good, Lisbeth thought. It would keep her awake from her remaining hour. Kimber said, "My husband left me for our nanny, whom he has now impregnated. And let me tell you, that was a wake-up call." Yes, you told me, Lisbeth thought. She'd had a wake-up call of her own, though she didn't want to tell Kimber Marsh about her breakup with JJ. She was so tired, she was sure she'd start to cry. "I'm going to use this summer to reconnect with my kids," Kimber said. "I traveled so often for work, I barely saw them. They were always with Jenny, our nanny. Honestly, it's no wonder Craig left me for her. I was never around, so she slotted herself right into my vacant place and became not only a substitute mom, but a substitute wife." Kimber leaned in. "That's why the kids are so consumed with the reading and the chess. Something was missing from their little lives, and that something was me." Kimber sipped her coffee and reached for a copy of the Blue Book sitting on the desk. "Starting tomorrow, I'm going to do better. I'm going to do all the suggested itineraries in this guidebook." The following day, Thursday, Kimber and the kids took Doug to Tuppency Links for a long walk. Then they went to Barnaby's place to do an art project, had lunch at Something Natural, and spent the afternoon on Children's Beach. But on Friday, Kimber plopped herself under an umbrella by the pool and read, while Louie played chess in the lobby and Wanda interviewed hotel guests and Zeke took Doug out to do his business. On Saturday, Kimber didn't come down from her room until late afternoon. When she did, she had her laptop with her. She announced she was going to sit in the lobby and write her memoirs. Okay, Lisbeth thought. At least Kimber could keep an eye on Wanda, who was finishing the last Nancy Drew mystery she had, and Louis, who was playing chess against himself. But Lisbeth felt dismayed that the Marsh family had spent the entire day inside. Late June days on Nantucket were the gold standard for the season. Blue skies, plentiful sunshine, lilacs and cherry blossoms, and without the overbearing heat and humidity of July and August. But Sunday morning, Kimber rebounded and took the kids strawberry picking at Bartlett's farm. When they came back, Wanda walked into the lobby proudly holding an overflowing quart of luridly red fruit. While Lisbeth was pleased they had gotten out, she couldn't help thinking about the pristine white linens on the beds and the Annie Selke rug, so she offered to wash the strawberries and let the children eat them over soft-serve vanilla ice cream in the break room. Both Wanda and Louie had been gobsmacked by the ice cream machine. "I want to work here when I grow up," Wanda announced. Then, at 10:15 on Sunday evening, when Lisbeth was fading fast, she'd worked double shifts for 7 straight days. Kimber Marsh came flying into the lobby in what Lisbeth's mother would have called a dither. "Wanda wasn't in her bed," she said.
"Have you seen Wanda?"
Kimber practically screamed.
"Have you seen her?"
"I haven't," Lisbeth said. She did a sweep of the lobby, checking Wanda's favorite reading chair and under the piano where, inexplicably, Wanda sometimes liked to read, then said, "Let me look in the break room." The allure of the soft serve machine was strong. Lisbeth had to fight it herself each and every day. But the break room was empty. Lisbeth enlisted Raoul's help. He would search the hotel, floor by floor. Kimber asked if it might be possible for her to let Doug out of their suite. She was certain he would lead them right to Wanda. Lisbeth hesitated. The last thing she wanted was a pit bull roaming the halls of the hotel. But Lisbeth sensed the urgency. An 8-year-old child was missing at 10:15 at night, so she okayed it. Raoul called up from the wellness center, no Wanda.
"I thought she might be in the yoga room," Raoul said. "That fountain is mesmerizing."
He was now moving to the first floor.
"Check all the unoccupied rooms, please," Lisbeth said.
There were 21 empty rooms and 6 empty suites. Lisbeth felt each vacancy like a pinhole in her heart.
"Maybe she found a way in. Lisbeth tried to think like Wanda. She seemed fascinated by the other guests, so Lisbeth poked her head into the only populated area of the hotel, the Blue Bar. And wow, the place was popping. The bar was 3 deep. Every seat was occupied. The copper disco ball had dropped, and a group of people were dancing to Tainted Love in the space in front of the penny wall. Lisbeth surveyed the crowd at hip level and tried to peer under tables. There was no sign of Wanda anywhere, though Lisbeth spied plenty of people drinking flame-red cocktails, the Heartbreaker. When Lisbeth got back to the desk, a round, middle-aged woman wearing glasses with dark, square frames and a fanny pack around her waist, she looked like an aging version of Velma from Scooby-Doo, was standing at the desk. "Finally," she huffed.
"I'm so sorry," Lisbeth said. "You must be Ms. Yates?"
"I arrived over 5 minutes ago, and you're the first person I've seen." Lisbeth returned to her spot behind her computer just as Raoul came rushing down the corridor saying, "I'm headed up to the second floor." Lisbeth gave Raoul the thumbs up. She was afraid if she spoke, she would lose her cool. A child missing in the hotel, she thought, or not in the hotel. When was the right time to call the police?
"I'll need a form of ID and your credit card, please, Ms. Yates."
Franny Yates pulled both a Pennsylvania driver's license and a MasterCard out of her fanny pack.
"You're certainly traveling light," Lisbeth said.
"My luggage is down on the sidewalk," Franny said. "It's far too heavy for me to carry up the stairs. Silly me, I thought a hotel that costs as much as this one does might actually have a bellman."
"We do have a bellman," Lisbeth said. "Right now, he's assisting another guest. I'm happy to fetch your luggage."
"You won't be able to get it up the stairs," Franny said.
Lisbeth winked at Franny.
"You haven't seen me with kettlebells."
But when Lisbeth went to the hotel's entrance and looked down the staircase, she saw 3 black suitcases that were each big enough to contain a dead body. Franny Yates was staying at the hotel for only 3 nights. What could she possibly have packed?
Lisbeth returned to the desk. "My apologies. You were absolutely correct. We'll have to wait for Raoul."
"How long will he be?" Franny asked, checking her phone. "I'd like to get to bed."
"Of course," Lisbeth said. Just then, Raoul called. "She's not on the second floor, and Kimber says she and Doug checked the 3rd floor and she's not there either. I'll sweep the 4th floor. You've checked the pools, yes?"
"Pools?" Lisbeth said. She started to tremble. "No."
"Oh, man," Raoul said.
Lisbeth hung up. She held prayer hands up to Franny. "I'll be back in just a minute."
"But my room number, my key? My luggage is still on the sidewalk. What if someone takes it?"
"This is Nantucket," Lisbeth said. "No one is going to touch it, and it's too big for anyone to walk away with. I'll get your keys as soon as—"
But Lisbeth didn't finish the sentence. She hurried out the pool door, praying she wasn't going to see the small form of Wanda Marsh floating face down. Both children could swim, she reminded herself. She hit the pool lights. No Wanda. She exhaled, but there was still the adult pool on the lower level and the hot tub. She recalled that Wanda was intensely curious about the mystery of the hot tub because it was restricted to people 14 and older. Lisbeth raced back through the lobby, passing Franny Yates, who had plopped herself cross-legged on the floor in front of the desk, which Lisbeth understood was some kind of statement or protest because there were armchairs and ottomans less than 5 feet away.
"Be right," Lisbeth said.
She ran down the stairs, through the wellness center, and out the door. The adult pool was dark and quiet.
"Wanda?"
Lisbeth whispered. She peered into the hot tub, feeling very much like the doomed heroine in a horror film. It was empty. Lisbeth headed back upstairs, thinking she had dodged a huge bullet. Wanda hadn't drowned in the pools. Though Lisbeth was growing more and more agitated, where was she?
"Let me get your keys," Lisbeth said to Franny Yates. "I'll upgrade you to a suite because you've been so patient. Here you go, suite 214. You can take either the stairs or the elevator to the 2nd floor, and then it's all the way down the hall to the left."
"What about my luggage?" Franny Yates said.
As soon as the bellman is free, I'll have him bring it to you. I want to go to sleep.
Ms. Yates, I need to ask for your indulgence. We have a situation here. Your situation is that your hotel stinks, Franny Yates said. She marched off down the hall.
Lisbeth wasn't sure what to do. Should she try to schlep Franny Yates' luggage up the stairs herself? Should she go up to the fourth floor to help look for Wanda? Should she call the police? A child is lost. Lisbeth wasn't a mother, but she understood how serious this was. Lisbeth went down the stairs to the street and looked both ways. No Wanda. She heard the phone ringing back in the lobby, and she hustled up the stairs, taking them two at a time. So when she reached the top, her heart was pounding in her ears. Hello?
We found her, Raoul said. She was wandering around the fourth floor.
Oh, thank God. Lisbeth paused. What was she doing there?
The fourth floor had odd roof angles and very small windows, and the Historic District Commission would have to approve any structural changes that would be visible from the street, so Xavier had opted not to renovate it just yet. Lisbeth had ventured up to the fourth floor only once. It was, essentially, a cavernous and dusty attic.
Raoul said, She said she was looking for the ghost.
The ghost? Lisbeth thought. She had been very careful never to mention the supposed ghost to anyone, and especially not Wanda. But Zeke might have let it slip. We have a check-in to Suite 214, who is very anxious for her bags. There were three of them, and I would deliver them myself, but they're each the size of a small home.
I'll be down as soon as I'm finished cleaning up here.
Cleaning up? Lisbeth said.
Doug was so excited to see Wanda that he had an accident.
Lisbeth closed her eyes. The other line of the hotel phone rang. It was Suite 214.
You have to get Suite 214 her luggage. Please, Raoul, right now.
But the dog.
Raoul, please.
Yes, boss, Raoul said.
Lisbeth answered the other line.
Your luggage is on its way, Ms. Yates.
You're a liar, Franny Yates yelled. I can see my luggage from my window. It's still on the sidewalk. Franny Yates's review is factually correct. It took Raoul a full 30 minutes to deliver her luggage. Both Lisbeth and Raoul were harried and distracted, and Lisbeth was, perhaps, a bit snippy. But was the check-in an unmitigated disaster? No. An unmitigated disaster would have been Wanda staying missing or found dead. Lisbeth had comped Franny Yates's entire bill at the Blue Bar, three nights, $260. Why didn't her review mention the comped meals? Lisbeth clicks out of the email from Xavier and rests her head, ever so briefly, on her desk. It's 7:30 in the morning and she's so tired, she could sleep until 7:30 tomorrow morning. She's so demoralized, she feels like crying. Or crying uncle. She needs a night auditor.
Chapter 8. Lie, Cheat, and Steal. Grace tightens the belt of her robe and does her usual nocturnal sweep through the hotel, beginning with the room where Louis and Wanda are sleeping. They've been taking turns in each of the four bunks. Tonight, they're both in uppers. Wanda has her notepad tucked under her pillow, and Louis has fallen asleep in his glasses, clutching the white queen piece. Grace can hear Doug the dog snoring in the other room. He always lies in front of the door of the suite. If Grace goes anywhere near him, he'll wake up and snarl. Kimber, the mother, sleeps with her arms and legs in an X. She looks like a blue and green-haired angel fallen from the sky. Grace floats out of Suite 114 and pops in to check on the Belfleurs in room 306. Oops, sorry to interrupt. Then to Suite 216, where Mrs. Reginella is scrolling through the text messages on her husband's cell phone, and then down to room 111, where Arnold Dash sleeps with the urn of his wife's ashes on the nightstand. Grace wishes there were more action. She hopes that as July gets closer, occupancy will increase. The hotel is so welcoming, the staff so attuned to every detail. What's keeping the guests away?
Maybe there's too much competition, or maybe it's too expensive. After all, when this was a family-friendly budget hotel, it was jam-packed. Maybe the hotel's reputation is too damaged to rehabilitate. Is that her fault? She wonders whatever happened to the article that lovely young woman, Jill Tannenbaum, came to write. As far as Grace knows, it hasn't been printed. Suddenly, Grace catches a whiff of something that smells like a passing garbage truck, and she realizes a new threat is about to enter the hotel. She swoops down to the lobby, which is warmly lit with Nora Jones playing over the sound system. Lisbeth is at her post at the desk, perusing summer dresses on the Alice and Olivia website. Grace can hear people in the blue bar chanting, "Don't stop believin'," which is par for the course. The disco ball dropped over an hour ago. Everything seems to be in order, but nevertheless, Grace's hackles are up. There's a predator approaching. She hears footsteps on the stairs. A figure walks through the doors of the hotel. "Really?" Grace thinks. "This guy?" Lisbeth is so tired when she interviews Richard DeCameron, a 54-year-old father of three from Avon, Connecticut, who has answered her prayers and applied for the job of night auditor, that the exchange has a dreamlike quality. He arrives at the hotel at 10:30 at night, fresh off the late ferry, but he's as ebullient and chipper as a QVC host trying to sell you the leaf blower that will change your life. He's dressed like it's casual Friday at the hedge fund office, in a navy blue spring suit, a navy and yellow checked shirt, and chocolate suede Gucci loafers without socks. He has a dad bod, a bit of a paunch, and gray hair thinning on top, but his smile and his twinkling eyes are appealing. He gives Lisbeth strong vibes of guys she knew in college, the fun, good-natured best friends of the hot jock jerks everyone was in love with. Richard DeCameron, he asks her to call him Richie, was the guy who actually stuck around to make sure you got in a cab after you did that last ill-advised shot of tequila. Lisbeth prints out his resume. He was an executive in the insurance business in Hartford for 30 years, and for the past 2 years, he's been working for something called Kick City. "This Kick City? I'm not familiar with it," Lisbeth says. "It's a sneaker broker website," Richie says. "When athletes or rappers drop a limited edition shoe, our brokers snap them up and resell them. I'm sure it sounds like kid stuff, but trust me, it's big business." "What inspired you to make the switch?" Lisbeth asks. "I wanted a change from insurance, something with a little more sex appeal." "And what brings you to Nantucket?" Richie sighs. "I'm divorced. My ex-wife has recently started dating again. The new guy lives in the same town that I do, and it got a little claustrophobic. So I decided to treat myself to a summer at the beach. I'm a night owl by nature, so when I saw you advertising for a night auditor, I thought I'd reach out."
"Do you have housing?" Lisbeth asks.
Please say yes, she thinks. She wants a night auditor so badly she might let Richie sleep in one of the empty rooms. The rest of the staff would, no doubt, mutiny.
"I'm staying at the hotel out by the airport tonight," he says. "Tomorrow I have an appointment with a woman who's renting a room in her home on Cliff Road."
"Ah, wonderful. And you're familiar with FreshBooks? You'll be fully responsible for preparing guest invoices."
"I have all kinds of system software experience," Richie says. "I'm a numbers guy. I was a math major at UConn back in the day." He pumps a fist. "Go Huskies!"
She likes his energy, especially so late at night.
"How comfortable are you with guest interaction?"
"I talk to everyone. My kids find it embarrassing."
"How old are your kids?"
Lisbeth is asking just to be polite. She's going to hire this guy.
"Kingsley is 13, Crenshaw is 11, and Millbrook is 8. He pulls out his phone. "Here's a picture of our family in happier times."
Grace hovers above so that she can scrutinize the photo. There's a slightly younger version of Richie posing next to a pretty brunette with three smiling children arranged in front of them. There's a river, a water wheel, trees aflame with color. It's autumn.
The youngest child is holding a basket of apples. This family looks happy. Grace notices Richie's hand trembling ever so slightly as he gives the phone to Lisbeth, who beams at the photo. Is she, like Grace, wondering what happened to the marriage? Will your children get a chance to visit Nantucket this summer? Lisbeth asks.
Haven't gotten that far yet, Richie says. I'm just trying to get a viable situation in place.
Well, if this helps, I'm happy to offer you the position of night auditor. It'll be 6 nights a week, I'm afraid. I can only cover one night and still keep my sanity.
I'm happy to work 7 nights, Richie says. I'd prefer it. It'll keep me out of trouble. It's best that I keep busy so I don't miss my kids as much.
Lisbeth exhales with obvious relief and looks right at the space that Grace is occupying. For the first time, Grace wonders if maybe Lisbeth is supernaturally sensitive and can see a stolen hotel bathrobe and her missing Minnesota Twins cap floating in the air. Definitely not, Grace thinks. The poor woman is merely exhausted. But even so, Grace rises a bit. Lisbeth says, "We have a family in Suite 114, a mother with 2 children. They're paying their bill in cash. You'll invoice them every week, and then Kimber, that's the mother, will bring down cash, which you can just keep in the safe until I find time to go to the bank to deposit it." She smiles. "I can trust you with the safe combination?" Richie laughs.
"My references will all vouch that I'm a perfectly average, good enough guy."
"Have you ever done any marketing?" Lisbeth asks.
"I sat in on all the meetings at Kick City."
Lisbeth frowns. "Occupancy at the hotel is below 50%, and I just don't understand why. The hotel was, admittedly, mediocre for a long time. I'm not sure if it's the lackluster reputation we're grappling with or..."
"Or?"
"Well, some people say there's a ghost."
Richie hoots. "The hotel is haunted? That's fantastic! I would think that would draw people to the hotel rather than keep them away. You should be promoting the ghost story."
"We should," Lisbeth says.
"Absolutely yes," Richie says. "Advertise the ghost. Market the ghost."
Grace thinks. There's still a stench coming off Richie Decameron. Something's wrong. She can't say what. But she's willing to plug her nose and ignore it because it sounds like Richie is interested in her story.
"Hello, Richie,"
she calls out nasally, though of course he can't hear her.
"I'm here. I was murdered."
Everything Alessandra Powell owns fits into 2 knockoff Louis Vuitton duffels that she bought at the Mercato di Sant'Ambrogio in Florence. Michael told Alessandra that his wife and children were due on island on June 18th, but Alessandra had wormed her way so deeply into Michael's psyche that she thought, just maybe, he would decide to leave his wife. It would be quite a coup, though not her biggest. That would be Giacomo, who gave up both his runway model mistress and his heiress wife for Alessandra. From what Alessandra can tell, Heidi Bick is the kind of wife and mother who meets her besties for yoga every morning after dropping the children off at their progressive and obscenely expensive private schools, then swings by the organic grocery on her way home so she can whip up whatever eclectic dish Sam Sifton has recommended that day in his New York Times cooking column. On Wednesday, maybe a tadig. Heidi not only takes care of the 4 Bick children, she's also the point person for Michael's father, who has Parkinson's. Alessandra met Michael Bick on the fast ferry back in early April. Alessandra had feared it would be slim pickings as far as male prospects were concerned. Nearly all the men were sporting Carhartts and work boots and dropping their R's. But then Alessandra spied Michael with the Vacheron watch and his Master of the Universe posture. At the ferry snack bar, he ordered a Sam Adams and a clam chowder, and Alessandra popped behind him in line and ordered the same. She took a seat 1 row over facing him and pulled out her well-worn copy of The Sun Also Rises. She drank her beer, let her chowder cool, and, surprise, surprise, caught Michael staring at her.
"I'm sorry," he said.
It's not every day I see a beautiful woman drinking a beer and reading Hemingway.
By the end of the ride, Michael had moved into the seat across from Alessandra and bought them another round of beers. Their respective chowders had gone untouched, and Alessandra's book lay face down, forgotten. They had both stretched the truth about their situations. Michael said he was taking some time apart from his wife, who was back in Greenwich with the kids. Alessandra said she had been living in Europe for the past 8 years and was treating herself to an American summer. "The Riviera gets old after a while," she said, making them both laugh. He invited her over to his place for a drink. She told him she had to check into her Airbnb. She didn't have one booked. He insisted, spinning her Cartier love bracelet and saying, "Unless your heart belongs to the person who gave you this?"
No,
she said, regarding the bracelet as she might a handcuff. Giacomo had given it to her a few weeks before he was sent to prison.
"Great," Michael said. "Then come for a drink."
"I really can't."
"Just one, please."
The house was more than Alessandra could have hoped for. It was one of the huge old family cottages right on the harbor that they'd passed on the ferry. It had a long, elegant pool that fronted their tiny private beach and a tennis court in the side yard.
"Do you play?" Michael asked.
"A little," Alessandra said.
The inside of the house was tasteful and fresh, magazine-worthy. Lots of white wainscoting and exposed blonde beams and a massive stone fireplace and a table behind the wide, deep sofa laden with silver-framed photographs. The wife he was supposedly taking some time apart from and the four children. Michael kissed her outside on the deck, right away biting her lower lip. He wrapped his hand in a length of her hair, tugging a little to let her know who was in charge. He, erroneously, thought this was him. He slid his mouth down to her neck, lingering in the kill spot just below her ear. Good boy. He'd been well trained by wifey. Though Alessandra would bet $1 million he no longer kissed Heidi Bick this way. He unbuttoned Alessandra's blouse slowly, his pinky just barely grazing her nipple, and Alessandra felt a pulsing between her legs that was replicated by the ruby beacon of Brant Point light in the distance. He had her panting, shirt open, breasts exposed, jeans unzipped, when he turned and walked back into the house. Alessandra waited a second, wondering if he was having a crisis of conscience. She chastised herself. She had made a poor choice. When she finally followed him inside, she had to let her eyes adjust to the dark. There was milky moonlight through a window, blue numbers on a cable box, and then hands grabbed her waist and she screamed, genuinely frightened, and realized she wasn't in charge at all. She also realized Michael Bick had, very likely, brought home women he didn't know before. Possibly he did it all the time. But in the pearl-gray light of morning, fog covered the harbor like a layer of dust on an antique mirror. Michael traced one of her eyebrows and said,
"Where did you come from, Alessandra Powell?"
That was the question, wasn't it?
Alessandra was originally from San Francisco, where her mother Valerie waited tables at the storied Tosca Cafe in North Beach. Valerie and Alessandra lived in a building down the street from the restaurant. Valerie kept their apartment clean, didn't drink too much, wine occasionally, and didn't do drugs, weed occasionally. There was always enough money for groceries and for Alessandra to get ice cream down on the pier or go to the movies or, when she was older, take the bus to Oakland and thrift shop. But there was something a little off about Alessandra's upbringing. While Alessandra's friends were opening presents around the tree on Christmas morning, then sitting down to a rib roast, Alessandra was home alone watching R-rated movies on cable while her mother worked a double. She and her mother opened their Christmas presents on the 26th with eggs and a tin of Ocetra caviar and Springsteen singing "Santa Claus is Coming to Town." On Easter, while Alessandra's friends were going to church and hunting for eggs and slicing into honey-baked ham,
Alessandra was watching R-rated movies on cable and eating straight from a bag of jelly beans that her mother bought as a nod to the holiday, even though she didn't celebrate Easter at all. And then there were the men. Every week, Valerie would bring home married men who frequented the Tosca bar while they were in the city on business. These men would arrive after Alessandra went to bed, but she heard them in the shower the next morning while Alessandra's mother ransacked their wallets in the bedroom. Every once in a while, one of the men would stay for breakfast and listen as Valerie played her favorite CD and sang along, "Torn Between Two Lovers, Feeling Like a Fool." Alessandra knew better than to follow in her mother's footsteps, but it was the only example she had. When Alessandra was 18, she seduced Dr. Andrew Beecham, the father of her best friend, Duffy. After Alessandra and Drew had been sleeping together for a few weeks, Alessandra realized she could cash in on the power she had, the power to tell Duffy and Drew's wife, Mary Lou, and get something valuable in return. Drew was the chair of the Romance Languages department at Stanford. Alessandra audited a full year of classes, Italian, Spanish, French literature, art history, and then demanded a one-way plane ticket to Rome, which Drew Beecham was only too happy to buy for her. "Where did you come from, Alessandra Powell?" Alessandra answered Michael in her prettiest Italian,
"Poiché la tua domanda cerca un significato profondo, risponderò con parole semplici."
She smiled. She had no intention of translating. "That's Dante." Michael Bick kissed her tenderly. She was making progress. She stayed the next night and the next. She made Michael milk-braised pork with hand-rolled gnocchi in sage and butter and a salad of bitter greens. She made coq au vin. She made scrambled eggs the way her mother used to make them for other women's husbands, with double the yolks. Double the yolk scrambled eggs after a night of whiskey, Valerie used to say, felt a lot like love. Alessandra beat Michael soundly in tennis. In Ibiza, she had taken lessons with Nadal's first coach. When they made love, she screamed out in Italian. She didn't complain that they never went anywhere together. Not to dinner or coffee, not for walks on the beach or in the state forest, not for drives to Great Point or Sconset. When the guy came to fix the internet, she greeted him in French and told him she was the au pair. Secretly, Alessandra secured a job at the Hotel Nantucket that would start in June, though she hoped by then Michael would have fallen so deeply in love with her that he would tell Heidi their marriage was over, and Alessandra could simply slip into Heidi's place. She would go to Surfside all day while Michael worked at home on his laptop. While he was sleeping, Alessandra had hacked into his computer and learned that he traded petroleum futures and in 2021 had reported $10,793,000 in income. And she would accompany him to Cisco Brewers to hear live music and to his standing Thursday night reservation at Ventuno. She would become best friends with the Leightons next door. The families were so close that they each had a set of keys to the other's house. She would bewitch everyone in Michael's life exactly the way she had bewitched him. But this didn't quite happen. A few days before Alessandra started work, she overheard Michael on the phone with Heidi and his kids, his voice sweet and upbeat and guileless.
"How was the game, Colby? Did you hit the ball? Did you swing? Hey, buddy, did you see Dustin Johnson sink that putt on the ninth? I love you. I love you. I love you more. Kisses. Can't wait to see you all. Only 2 more weeks. I'm getting the boat ready. Coat 2, here we come."
Alessandra felt most affronted by this last bit. She hadn't realized Michael had a boat. She went to work at the hotel on opening day, disappearing from the house while Michael was on the phone, and she ignored all his calls. Let him wonder. When she walked in the door that evening, he was visibly shaken.
"Where were you?" he said.
She narrowed her eyes and tried to read his face. Why did he care? How much did he care? She shrugged. "Out." A tirade followed. It was the first time she'd seen him angry, other than when the Wi-Fi went down, but that was different.
and it interested her. Worried sick, went driving around looking for you. You just left without a word. The only way I knew you were coming back was your luggage was still here.
Do you love me?
She wondered. She thought the answer might be yes, but it wouldn't be enough.
I got a job, she said,
working the front desk at the Hotel Nantucket.
Michael's face turned pill white.
What?
Alessandra stared him down.
Michael said, my friend Lisbeth Keaton is working there. She's the GM, I heard. Is she the one who hired you?
Yes.
Michael nodded slowly, then backed away half a step, as though Alessandra were holding a gun.
You didn't tell her where you were living, did you?
Obviously not.
Alessandra didn't tell Michael that Lisbeth had followed her home. Thankfully, Alessandra had spied her in the bike's mirror before she'd turned into the driveway. Relief softened his face.
Okay, good. I wouldn't want people to get the wrong idea.
What you mean, Alessandra said, is that you wouldn't want people to get the right idea, which is that you're keeping a lover even though you are still fully married. Your wife has no idea you needed space. She thinks you came up here to switch out the storm windows for screens and tackle a top-secret project for work, which seems outrageous, but she doesn't question it because she trusts you, and she's probably enjoying the time apart. She feeds the kids pizza 3 nights a week and goes out with her girlfriends to the new wine bar and flirts with the cute bartender, and then goes home and curls up with her vibrator. Alessandra stopped to breathe. You're a liar and a cheat.
Michael cleared his throat. They're coming up on the 18th, so you'll need to go.
Will I? Alessandra said.
There was fear in his eyes. He was the one who had chosen poorly.
Baby, please.
I'm not your baby, Michael. I'm a grown woman whom you've treated like a concubine.
You knew what you were getting into, Michael said. You can't tell me you didn't understand what this was.
He got everything backward. He was the one who didn't understand what this was.
I'll go quietly the day before your family arrives, Alessandra said, on one condition.
Alessandra walks from Michael's house to the hotel with a knockoff Louis Vuitton bag in each hand. It's a stylish walk of shame, or it would be if Alessandra felt any shame. What she feels most is regret. Michael Bick is the complete package. He has looks, money, intelligence, humor, and even a basic decency, if you ignore the obvious. He asks questions, he listens to the answers, he's generous and curious and thoughtful. The sex was mind-blowing. Michael is the only man Alessandra ever met who didn't need to learn a thing or two in bed. And they are so compatible. Oh well. It has been Alessandra's experience that men like Michael Bick get scooped up early, in college or the first years of living as an adult in the city. She also feels triumphant. In her suede Bruno Magli clutch is a cashier's check for $50,000. Michael asked her to name her price, and she did so judiciously, unsure what she could get away with. But now she wonders if she could have asked for double. She won't worry about it. During their first week of sinful bliss, Alessandra watched Michael punch in the passcode to his phone, and later, while he was sleeping, Alessandra copied Heidi Bick's number. She also took pictures of herself in different spots throughout the house, in the pool, weighing herself on Heidi's scale, a trim 105, cooking in the kitchen, even sprawled out across the master bed, although they'd never had sex in that room, Michael's one nod to fidelity. If Alessandra doesn't find another situation, she'll simply text Michael the pictures and ask for more money. As Heidi Bick is checking things off her packing list in Greenwich, Colby's inhaler, Hayford's putter, her Wusthof tomato knife, Alessandra will be paying for a 1980 CJ7 in mint condition that she found listed in the Nantucket Standard classifieds. The Jeep costs $20,000. Alessandra will pay cash, then she'll write the bellman Adam a check for $12,000, which is her share of the summer's rent now that she's moving in with him and Raoul on Hooper Farm Road. She'll throw $10,000 at her credit card bills and still have a bit of a financial cushion.
Alessandra is growing weary of seducing men, then extorting them. She would far prefer to find a permanent provider. She marches up the front steps of the hotel, trying to carry herself like a hotel guest checking in. Except she's wearing her uniform, and Adam says from his spot behind the lectern,
"You look like a high-class hobo."
Alessandra doesn't respond. She pictures Michael frantically cleaning the house, sweeping up every strand of her hair, wiping her fingerprints off the wine glasses, checking the drawers for an errant pair of panties. But will he notice the Chanel eyeshadow that Alessandra left in Heidi's makeup drawer in the bathroom? Heidi wears Bobby Brown. Will he check the shoe tree in Heidi's closet, where Alessandra has left a pair of size 6 crystal-studded Rene Calvilla stilettos, winking coyly among the size 8 Jack Rogers sandals and Tory Burch ballet flats? Will he find the positive pregnancy test that Alessandra tucked into the copy of Jennifer Weiner's Good in Bed that sits atop the stack of novels on Heidi Bick's nightstand? He will not, Alessandra guesses, because men don't pay attention to the way women live. Not really. Michael will suffer for this, and for his hubris. He thought he was making a clean, if somewhat costly, getaway. She wonders if Michael misses her. After handing over the check, he kissed her deeply, and when she pulled away, she saw tears glittering in the corners of his eyes. "Torn between two lovers," she sang in her head, feeling like a fool.
"Raoul says he'll swing by around noon to get your bags,"
Adam says now. "Kind of him, thank you," Alessandra says, though she wishes Raoul would come right away so she could avoid the inevitable questions. Alessandra steps into the lobby and smells the deep roast of the Jamaica Blue Mountain coffee that Edie has percolating. They use a vintage percolator and the guests rave about the flavor. She hears Mandy Patinkin singing a Gershwin song, "They Can't Take That Away From Me." She's late due to the check, the kiss, the walk with the bags. She likes to arrive before Edie because she feels it gives her the upper hand. And now, when Edie looks up and sees Alessandra and notices the luggage, she looks confused and just a bit superior.
"Good morning, Alessandra," she says. "Taking a trip?"
Edie's voice is light and easy, despite the fact that Alessandra is always chilly with her. "Good morning, Edie." It's not that Alessandra doesn't like Edie, she does. Edie is smart, self-effacing, and excellent with the Marsh children. Both Wanda and Louis are terrified of Alessandra. But Edie is also young, and the last thing Alessandra wants is for Edie to look up to her. Alessandra doesn't want to lie to Edie about her past or her present, and hence, friendship between them is impossible. Alessandra has to push Edie away. "It's for your own good," Alessandra wants to say, because she can see her brusqueness hurts Edie.